All right, it's Erev Pesach, 5773, and we're going to review. So I wish I would have told you to bring your books, but I didn't. So you're just going to have to rely on me.
Okay.
So we're going to do mitzvot. I just want to review the ideas for Pesach, and it's mitzvot 5 through 21, minus 18, which is the sanctification of the firstborn. But otherwise, those are all Pesach mitzvahs. I'm going to give you a test. You guys are all smart enough to know this. Let's see if you get it. The first three mitzvot are in Sefer Bereishit. And there's only three mitzvahs altogether in the whole book. So Gold Star, if you remember what they are. And?
Rosh Chodesh.
And then the fourth mitzvah, before Pesach, what mitzvah is that? The first mitzvah in Shemot.
Before what?
Before Pesach mitzvahs, the first mitzvah in Sefer Shemot. So what do you think they are? So, okay, so let's just do Bereishit for a second, right?
Yeah.
So what's the first mitzvah in Bereishit?
Isn't it Rosh
Chodesh? Oh, Pru Arvu.
Good, Pru Arvu.
Right, be fruitful
number,
and multiply.
Right, and number two. Abraham got it. All the children of Abraham do this.
Circumcision.
Good.
Oh,
Bris
yeah.
Mila. Good. And number three, Yaakov. Story with Yaakov. Something we don't eat.
Oh, the muscle.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Those are the only three mitzvot in Sefer Bereishit. The fourth mitzvah, the one right before Pesach, the first mitzvah in Sefer Shemot.
I read this. In
you all know this.
Yeah.
The Jews came out of Mitzrayim before they got the laws of Pesach. They came out of Mitzrayim.
Shabbos.
And all together, they looked up in the...
It was.
That's right. That's number four. Oh, good. Good for you. Rosh Chodesh. Excellent.
I guess we flunked, guys.
Right. No, between us, we
got it. You got it. That's good. That's good.
I say that we got it. I didn't participate in it. I'm not taking
it. But just to review, because I want you to know that, too. You know, that's important to know. Three mitzvot in Sefer Bereishit. First mitzvah in Sefer Shemot is Chodesh Hazelechem, so Rosh Chodesh. Or, because it is right before Pesach, this newness shall be to you the first of newnesses. Right? That in order for us to become the Jewish people, which is what Pesach is about, we had to become a people of innovation, of newness, to be able to make new starts and constantly reinvent ourselves. So that elasticity and flexibility of the Jewish people had to be there first, and then everything else.
Okay. It had to be grounded in time.
It had to be grounded out of time. Above time. We transcend time. That's the Pesach, is stepping out of time.
Have to think about that.
Yeah, okay.
Well, because that's what Rosh Chodesh was, so that we would know. Otherwise, holidays would just be... Oh, let's have Pesach in October.
Well, okay, so
I'm not ready yet.
Well, yes and no. So one thing about Rosh Chodesh that's very important is that we call the month, not the moon. So we do not always go by the actual stage of the moon. It goes by how we call it and what we say. So and that's very clear among the calculations there, that it's not about the physical reality in the sky at all. We're not a moon-worshipping cult. We're not subjugating ourselves to the stages of the moon. We use it to check, but we're the ones who make the call. And we can even switch the date if we want to. We're the ones who call. So let's say Yom Kippur falls Erev Shabbos.
Right.
We can make the call and switch around the months somehow. I don't know all the calculations of how to do that. But we can. So it's not based on the physical reality. Because it could be that physically Yom Kippur should be there, and we can make it work out so that Yom Kippur is on Thursday, and then we have a Friday, and then we have a Shabbos, or something like that.
This year, though, it is. I mean, in 5774, it is.
Not Friday.
I thought it was.
It's never Friday. Never on a Friday.
You wouldn't be able to cook
I know,
Shabbos.
I know.
Right. It's never on a Friday. It could be on Shabbos.
I'll have to...
But it's never, ever on a Friday.
Right. On Shabbos, that's what I mean.
It could be on Shabbos.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
No problem.
Yeah, okay.
It could be on Shabbos.
Right.
That's not a problem. You can have it on Shabbos, but you can't have it on Friday.
That's what I was thinking.
Right. So, okay, so that's... Right, so we have to be outside of time. So we control the time of Rosh Chodesh, so Rosh Chodesh is not about being grounded in time, but it's being grounded in newness, and that we call the shots on that. We call the shots on who we are, too. It's about taking us out of the caste system as well, saying there's no such thing as who you're born into, that's what you are. That's not it. We're above and beyond that, and then we're above and beyond time. That's why Pesach was so quick. Right? It doesn't make sense that after 210 years of slavery, or 400 years from the very beginning, that we didn't know enough in advance that our bread could rise. I mean, really, we weren't... Think about how many people went out. 3 million people. Right? Even if it was only 600,000, but it's 600,000 males between the ages of 20 and 60. Their wives, their children, and the people over 60. Okay? So we have a count of about 3 million.
And some others, too.
And some others, right? So we're talking about in the range of 3 million.
Hello. Can you close the door behind you, please? Welcome.
Sandy and Marlon brought your daughter a gift.
After class, you have to open it because I want everybody to see it.
Anyway, right, so if you think about 3 million people going out, let's just think about that for a minute. 3 million people. That's a lot of people leaving a nation all at once. Right, so there's a few things that could go on. One is, you have to prepare for that. There's no way people can just jump out, right, and leave Egypt so quickly when there's 3 million. It's not like you just scoop up your kid and leave yourself. Like you, it's a big deal to leave that many. Not only is it a big deal to leave that many, but it would be easy to misread it. It'd be easy to think 3 million people, that's a slave's revolt. They won, right? They were able to rise up and finally beat the powers that were enslaving them and say, no, we don't agree to this anymore. And we are taking ourselves and our families out, and you can't stop us. We're too strong for you.
Well, that was only about a fifth, wasn't it? Is that the right number?
That's right.
Of the Jews that were there that could have left.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Right, that we do have the understanding that 4/5 died in the plague of darkness. So if 3 million exited... What's the math on that? Let's see. 4 times 3 is 12. So 50, there should have been 15 million.
Yeah.
15 million. In Egypt. Right? What's the population of Cairo today? Does anybody know? I know Egypt is the most populous state, I think. Right? Or is the most concentrated.
60 million.
60 million.
Yeah,
that's it's big.
A lot.
It's, yeah. People live in the cemeteries and mausoleums. Actually, in those buildings.
Lucky ones.
Yep. So anyway, so a lot of people are leaving. So it could easily look like a successful slaves revolt. And it doesn't make sense that so many people would be leaving without taking time to make proper provisions, especially when they expected
it. Right.
I mean, the plagues are happening. It took over a year, right? They know they're getting out at some point.
Well, and they knew they had to cross the desert.
Right. So how did they not have time for their, like, that they had to leave so quickly?
Well, because that was the only route.
Well, they're going to the Promised Land. They know where they're going.
But nobody left Egypt.
Yeah, but people knew the geography. They knew where they were headed. Yeah. Yeah. They knew. Because traders came all the time. People came back and forth. Hi. Yeah, people coming back and forth.
And before they were really enslaved, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of movement.
But Elisheva, just think about, 200 years ago in this country, right? So we know some of the things that happened. I mean, just from oral stories of...
Right. We're not slaves here.
It's true. But still, I mean, even the slaves here...
Right, they still...
They still knew they came from Africa. They still knew they had some names. They still had some traditions that they kept... They knew they came over the ocean, and if they wanted to get back, they'd have to go over an ocean, right? So, I mean, it's true that that wasn't just a one-time traversal, but it wasn't in Egypt either. People came back and forth, and they have the story of Yaakov and the sons and how they came to get food and go back and forth, right? So they knew that there was a path to go. Anyway, so it could... You wonder why, unfortunately, we're going to be using the first book today, so I'll just have to read to you.
It's passed over.
Not the right books.
Sorry, that's my fault.
No, we didn't get the email.
Because it wasn't sent.
You changed your cell phone because I called.
No.
Magic Jack or something?
No, that's not me. You must have missed that.
Oops. Anyway, I had to make sure we even were having, because I was thought we were.
Yeah, no, I don't have you on here.
720-9303. Uh-huh.
Right there. Yeah, 720-732-3636. Or just maybe clicked wrong, because sometimes cell phones do that. Click into the airwaves incorrectly. Anyway, so thinking about everybody coming out, right? It doesn't make sense that they didn't prepare properly or didn't have enough time. So there's a concept that came up, b'chipazon. The word is chipazon. They came out very quickly. So the very quickly meant that they were chased out by the Egyptians. The Egyptians had enough of them, right? 10 plagues. They wanted them out of there. So they chased them out. So it had to look like nobody had free will. Nobody did, except for Hashem. Right? They went out that quickly because Hashem is the only one who is acting with free will. So the Egyptians wanted them out, forced them out, and the Jews didn't have time to prepare, even though they were thinking of it the whole time. It had to be that quickly for a few reasons. One is to make it absolutely clear that this was not a successful slave revolt. Right, that this was the exodus from Egypt. This was God taking the people out, right? Using the agents of the Egyptians to chase them out. And then, of course, the Egyptians changed their mind right after it. So it shows that they, you know, who knows what they, everybody around could look at the Egyptians and say, they're like schizophrenic. You know, first they're out, then they're in, then they're out, then they can go, then they can't go, you know.
Well, and God kept trying to get Paro's agreement. I mean, every time Moshe went,
right,
he'd say okay, and then he'd say no.
Just kidding.
They'd say okay, just take your kids. It was a negotiation, right, almost like.
Yes, no. But that had nothing to do with releasing the Jews.
Right. Oh, it didn't?
No, nothing to do with releasing the Jews.
I haven't gotten that far with Rabbi Foreman.
Right. So this is from Rabbi Foreman, right. Okay. Just think about it, right? So, I mean, the way he asks the question is, your favorite people are enslaved by an evil nation. You're God. You have everything at your disposal to get them out because you're God. How will you release your favorite people from the slavery amongst an evil nation? You certainly don't have to get the permission of the ruler.
Right.
You're God. You know? Mm-hmm. You just take them out. You create a force field. You levitate them. You instantly blink them out. Like, there's a million ways to get them out. You for sure don't need Paro to agree or 10 plagues.
And yet, there was this constant a plague and a negotiation, a plague and a negotiation.
Right. Yeah, but it said that. But the question is, what was that about?
Yeah. Hashem kept hardening Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
Well,
why?
They had to have all these plagues to really build up the belief in Hashem.
Excellent. Right. That was the point. The plagues and the negotiations had nothing to do with getting the Jews out.
Right.
It had to do with a public display of God and God's powers for the Jews and for the non-Jews. The Jews needed to see it, and the non-Jews needed to see it. This was God's really, how do you say it? Not debut, but this was debutant. This was his debut in the world, really, his public debut. This was how he made his official announcement to the world, I'm God, and I run everything. And this is why God's first name, this is why it was a big deal coming up with the name. Mm-hmm. Right? God's name is used in different places throughout. Right? And we have all kinds of different names for God in the Torah before we get to the Exodus. But then when Moshe says, there's a whole big thing about God's name, right? So first, when Moshe goes to Paro and says, God said we have to get out. And Paro said, okay, I know about a lot of gods, but I never heard of this one. It's not that we're atheists. We're polytheists. Mm-hmm. We believe in hundreds of gods, but I never heard of this one. What is his name? Right? And he looks for it in his files. Nope. Never heard of this one. And also, when Moshe says, okay, I'll go to, God says, go to the people and tell them you're going to get out. And Moshe says, okay, what should I say you're called?
I am who I am.
Right? But the Jews knew God. They're the children of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, all of whom had encounters with Elohim, with Hashem, with Shekhai, like different names, right? What do you mean, what should I tell them you're called? He's been introduced quite a few times, right? And that is where we have I am, that which I am, Eye Asher Eye, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have this concept of the Yud Kei Vav Kei name, which had been used before. But looking at it, Rabbi Foreman has a nice graphic where he puts the Hayah, Hoveh, and Yehyeh on top of each other. So that once you see them layered on top of each other, you could see that Hayah, past, hoveh, present, yihyeh, future, nice, on top of each other makes nice the yud and the kay and the vav and the kay, so that is not rooted in time, transcending time, that Hashem is all time, that he's not stuck
in time. It's not that he was, or that he will be,
or that he is. He's just bigger than all that.
Bigger than time.
Right, bigger than time, because he made time. Right, time is inside him. He's not inside time. So that's that name, and that's why the name is happening. But the name is also that. How will I introduce myself to the world? You have to know. I'm not this or that or that. I'm that. And I can't be contained in a definition. So the plagues and the negotiations were all about revealing that. It had nothing to do with getting the Jews out. However, once the Jews came out, they had to come out in a way that was clearly Hashem-driven. Not, because the whole point was to introduce Hashem to the world, right, and to the Jews to make sure it was clear forever, right? So you can't have it be able to be mistaken for a successful slave revolt. So that's why they had to get out so quickly that their bread couldn't even rise. And lechem oni, right, the bread of affliction, of course, every year at our Seder we make the joke, right? It's called poor person's bread. Why? Because it makes you poor to buy it. Right, but
try buying gluten free.
Right, try buying the gluten free. Right,
$9.95 a pound.
How much is it?
Nine.
That's the machine made. Yeah, the handmade is going to be in the low 20s. Because I think we paid 18. We paid 18 or 19.
Supers has Rosemont handmade for $33.
$33 a pound. Right, right. And what do we pay on the west side?
20.
Yeah. A pound.
Well, gluten-free.
A pound. Let me just tell you, a pound has 6 matzahs in it.
Oh, my God. I sent it to my aunt.
That's nothing. The same matzah is $13 less expensive on the west side?
The round matzahs.
Yeah.
King Super has
I saw the boxes of
it's
it.
It's a pound for $33.30.
So what's 20?
That's
if you order it through the West Side Co-op, through the shul, then you can get it for 20. But that's, I mean, I think it's only in the low 20s at the deli. I don't think it's in the low 30s.
You're right. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's a lot of money.
I just knew. Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of money.
Look at the prices of the Passover food.
Right. Anyway, let's not talk about that right now because we want to be happy. So
I'm happily broke.
Right. So, but it's called lechem oni. Let's do that for another minute. Okay. So lechem oni, it's poor person's food. Why? Why is it poor person's food? So first of all, it's just the most basic ingredients. All it is flour and water. That's it. Nothing else. Right. But it's more than that. More than it's just the most basic ingredients. Because tortillas are too, flour and water, and how yummy are they, right? But it has to be made quickly because a slave doesn't have his own time. You never know when you're going to be called to a task again. So you have to just quickly throw it together as fast as you can, cook it as fast as you can. There is no time to wait because you don't know if it's going to be ruined or not. You know, if you wait too long, if you'll be able to come back that day or the next, you don't have enough money to rebuy ingredients. So you just make it as fast as you can into something that will last. Right? Sort of like hardtack. My husband reads all kinds of old sailing novels. So the hardtack, which is like matzah. But once it's been on the boat for 6 months, unlike our matzah here in Denver where it's dry and nice, if you save it from year to year, which you could, on the boat, it gets weevils in it. Weevils. Mm-hmm. And that
and
apparently...
gets mushy too.
Well, apparently the weevils were an important source of protein. Yeah. For the sailors.
Are they kosher?
No, yeah. Weevils are not kosher.
Right, no. Yeah, it is no disgusting. But
it's good in protein.
Right, was well, important for them.
Yeah. Now decided she's not going to be a sailor.
Right.
No, well, right then. For me, right?
No sailing for you, right. So lechem oni, okay, so the first, so it's bread of affliction, right, because the bread of poor people, of slaves, it's a bread of poor people because they can't have it, they don't have enough money for ingredients and time to make it. And we had to make it to go out, it had to be made very quickly to go out, because we had to show that there was no time in the Exodus, that we were just squeezed out quickly. But also lechem oni, does anybody know another word for oni, another, it's a root that manifests in another word. Oni. What does oni mean?
Suffering.
Oni is suffering. What else is it?
Poor.
Pardon?
Poor.
Poor. Ani is poor. Oni is affliction. La'anot.
How do you spell it? Is it Oni? Is
Ayin. Ayin.
Ayin.
Right, Elishama is right. Answer. La'anot is to answer. Lish'ol is to ask. Mm. And la'anot is to answer, so it's also the bread of answers. Mm. So when we eat the lechem oni, it's interesting because we have a mitzvah to eat matzah.
It's your job to say that at our Seder.
Yeah, yeah. Remember this at the Seder, okay?
La'anot.
Remember this at the Seder because here's an important thing. You know, usually that leader of the Seder usually has the three matzahs, but there is an idea that I learned from Rabbi Yoel Unger yesterday to have the matzah on the table that everybody will be eating, rather than having it on the side, because, you know, there's not enough. In the three matzahs that you're going to break one for hamotzi and hand out a little piece to everybody, that's not enough for the whole shiur. There is a strong idea to have the rest of the matzahs that you're going to eat for that meal on the table. You could have it covered, but it should be on, even in a box, on the table, while you're telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, because it's the bread of answers. It's the bread that causes you to ask and causes you to answer and is there for the sake of telling the story of Mitzrayim over it. And so it's supposed to elicit from you those answers. And so you're supposed to eat that bread that made you answer. So it's important to, if you can, have that bread on the table.
Is it also the bread
to really absorb the answers so that you're eating the answers when you eat it.
Is it also the bread that God answered our affliction?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's nice.
God
that's
answered very nice. Our pleas.
That's very nice. I never heard that. That's very nice. A very nice thought.
Hey, you're talking.
Very nice.
Yes, very nice.
Working on our Seder.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Because we were obviously asking to get out.
Right, we were asking to get out.
Let my people go.
So who said let my people go?
Moshe,
right? Moshe, Hashem through Moshe, that's correct. But not the people. We have a clear tradition that the people, their koach hadibur was also enslaved. They couldn't really speak for themselves. Mm-mm. Even their tefillah was enslaved. That's one of the important things about the Seder. That's why we talk so much at the Seder, why the mitzvah of talking is so important at the Seder. Because, again, with the lechem oni, a slave who's oppressed can't ask a question. All they can do is answer to their master's demands, right? That's also about the oni. If you're oppressed or afflicted, you are an answerer, right? You're told what to do and you just do it. You don't ask, you just do. You're an answerer. So at the Seder, we flip it around. The central part of the Seder is asking, right? Asking questions. Where do we find the... Did I finish that thought? Let me just go back to it for a minute. All right, the people couldn't ask. All they could do is groan. Right? It's an interesting thing just to think about the parallels. I think I mentioned this last year, but just to have in mind the parallels between the two Rosh Hashanahs. We have four Rosh Hashanahs that the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah talks about. Two of them are the main Rosh Hashanah that we call Rosh Hashanah, and Pesach, the beginning of Nisan, is a Rosh Hashanah. Right? It's the first of the months. So, and it, associated with both Rosh Hashanahs is a nonverbal tefillah, right? So associated with the Tishrei Rosh Hashanah is the shofar, and associated with the Pesach Rosh Hashanah is the groaning, right? Because it says God heard their groaning. He answered that, their groaning, not their prayers, because they didn't have them. They didn't have words to get out. They just had the groaning, and that's what God answered. Was there groaning? Let's see, where was I headed after that? I wanted to make sure I finished that thought.
We're talking slaves couldn't ask questions.
Right. Okay, thank you, right. Right, so here at the Seder, we start by asking questions and asking questions and asking questions. Where are the answers to those four questions? Four discreet, clear questions that are asked by the youngest at the Seder. And where are the answers?
It doesn't really matter, it's about the questions.
So that's for sure one answer. It doesn't matter. It's about the questions.
It's really not in the Magid.
It is not in the Magid.
I mean, you really don't see it there.
No, you do not.
Why do you lean? It never says.
Never does. That's correct.
You know.
Right. It doesn't. Those questions are not answered. Instead, a dynamic conversation is begun. Right? This is for Laura.
No, for sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Isuk b'Torah. This is, right, so that it's not that you ask the question and you get the answer and it's a nice clean package and that's the way it is. It's that the questions are there to be heard and then expanded upon. Oh, you're curious about this? Well, let me fill you in a little bit. Our forefathers were slaves in Egypt. And expand. It's all about making the question bigger and making you feel more connected through it and engaging you in it and maybe not fully satisfying the curiosity. If you answer the question, then the question's been answered. Help them develop more questions and keep them engaged.
But it also is a great example of the proof of the need for oral law.
Yes.
You know, so we have a house in the mountains, and so I have this little notebook that I keep if somebody goes up there. It's got every detail in it, and I make a joke. It's like the oral and the written law all together. And it's why we don't have written in the oral law, because there's so much there. It's like reading instructions to anything. You'd be like, whatever. Like, you would never even read it. You'd never even pick it up, because everything's in it.
Right.
So this is an example of why we know that there is an oral law, why God designed it, so that we would have something, we would have a Magid, and we would not have all of the information in it.
Right.
Because we rely on the fact that we have to discuss it. So that's why my burglar alarm's always going off.
Well, it just dawned on me now, that's why it says in the Haggadah that Rabbi Akiva and the whole group sat up all night and talked. So that was a real, you know, give and take, a shear. They were really fleshing these questions out and the answers for all their disciples and everything.
Right. Well, if you go on the west side, the question the next day is...
How 2 o'clock?
How late was your Seder? Yeah. It's all the status. 2, we went to 3. Well, we just finished singing by 3, but we continued discussing till 4. Because the adults, too, the super yeshivish ones, yes. It's so funny when I was sitting with Rabbi Unger yesterday, so he was saying, you know, we usually go to 3. Just the singing, you know, the singing till 3. He wanted to make it clear that, like, they weren't finished at 3.
So came up to our house yesterday and said, I bet our Seder finishes after your Seder. And she was like, I bet you're right. No, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's in my family, my nephew is like just absolutely, you know, the wannabe rabbi soon, but he's like, 2 o'clock, gotta go till 2 o'clock. Well, when his friends started peeling off last year, he was really upset. And this year he's made a real effort because his soon to be brother in law is coming to his very first Seder.
Oh.
And he said, okay, I'm gonna keep it to an hour.
An hour? Wow.
Well, you know, he's trying to engage his soon-to-be brother.
So there's other ways.
Rabbi Meyer, you just do what you do.
Yeah.
You start it on time, you have your Seder, and people will come and go.
That's right. Right.
No one made it easier for us when we were becoming connected in that way. So we learned that if we wanted to stay connected, we needed to just take a nap.
Learn how to do it, yeah. Right, take a nap. So you should take a nap beforehand. Take a nap, get a babysitter, eat a meal.
That gets
for sure.
me to midnight.
Right.
It is hard.
The nap
yeah.
gets me
but,
to
and
midnight.
So, and, an old, yeah. and so I asked him specifically what to do with older people who are less patient. And he said it's fine. They should try to make it to the meal, and then they can bench and go to bed.
Yeah, no? I usually make it to the meal, and then, you know, I make it through the cups.
Mm-hmm. Right, the 4 cups are important. Right.
Yeah,
and you can finish up yourself.
Right.
Well, the 4 cups are important to finish if you can.
Well, I've been somewhere... It's not finished.
But you can finish on your own. You do not have to wait for everybody to finish.
Benji Brackman from Chabad told me an interesting thing. They start at 6 and have dinner first. Mm. Almost the whole dinner. Then they do the Seder. And then at Shulchan Aruch, they do dessert.
That's interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that is interesting.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was, you know, he has 120 people and to get them engaged.
Right.
Wow. Is that the one in Westminster?
So I'll share with you just 3 ideas that Rabbi Unger shared, 4 ideas. So 2 with the Afikoman. So so he used to hide different Afikomans. He made a rule, you can't begin to look for it until the Haggadah is over, so until Shulchan Aruch. So that way people have to stay at the table, first of all. Because I asked about that, because our kids used to disappear as soon as we hit it, and then like what? Then they're not engaged, right? So no looking until. But then he would hide multiple Afikomens, a few decoys, which would be labeled. So that way, if you found it and you open the package, you're like, oh, a decoy.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Yes. I was, so that was fun, right?
Yeah.
With all of his
shenanigans. Yes, he has shenanigans.
Yes, he does.
Another thing he did was one year. It was one of the grandkids' birthday before Pesach, so they had balloons around the house, and he had a big bouquet of balloons, which blended in, kind of, and he bought it specifically for this purpose, attached to a wicker basket with a weight holding it down. And then when it came time to the Afikomen, he took the weight out and put the matzah in and let go.
Oh, my gosh.
And he has extra high ceilings, and it went up to the top. And they had to pull it down with their skylight opener. Right, just to keep it fun, right? Another year, he hired a policeman to come at midnight. And the policeman comes in all creaking in leather and his, you know, whole outfit and everything. And he says, Rabbi Unger answers his door and he says, "Officer?" He says, "Yes, can I come in? I've heard of a rash of thefts in the neighborhood." So he steps in the door and he says, "I've heard of a rash of thefts of the Afikomen. Have you been affected by that?"
Oh,
is that great?
Well, I'm going to tell the kids to bring their important treasures,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to wrap them up in hobo bag. You know,
oh, that's
gotta
cute.
Got to go to Michael's,
right?
And get some sticks.
Oh, that's cute.
And I'm going to ask the adults to bring there at our first Seder. Uh-huh. I don't know that we'll do it at our second. Maybe we will. Uh-huh. And bring your treasures. And what is it that
you are supposed to walk around?
To you?
Uh-huh.
Take.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah,
that's important to take.
I haven't done it.
And then walking around, one thing my husband does, which is a Sephardic custom, is he takes the Afikomen and puts it on his shoulder, and he walks around the table. And then we all ask him, "Where are you coming from?" And he says, "I'm coming from the land of Egypt." "Where are you going?" "I'm going to the Holy Land." You know, so
nice.
We reenact all it. Yeah, it's a Sephardic thing, yeah. No, we're not that Sephardic. Anyway, if we were that Sephardic, we'd be Moroccan, and they don't eat rice.
Oh, yeah.
Or coffee or chocolate, because they're made from
beans.
No, legumes.
Yeah.
But we... Wait a minute. So we give up the occasional rice for coffee?
Yeah. I'll take the coffee, yeah.
Chocolate.
For sure, and the chocolate.
Can I say something that I just learned about rice? Because I learned that there is, you know, we can eat kidneys. Like, I don't know, Pesach starts like 11, like after 11:03 or something on Monday, right. We're not supposed to eat chametz, right? So, but we can eat kidneys.
Are you sure?
What?
That you can? I don't think so. I think from whenever the Sof Zman Achilat chametz, the end of eating chametz, is when you have to eat Pesach.
But you can eat kidneys, apparently.
I think you could eat gebracht, maybe. Are you sure you learned kidneys?
We have a Shiloh here.
That's interesting.
We have a Shiloh.
So that's interesting.
All right, so that would be one Shiloh to ask.
Uh-huh.
Only for that time, only until the Seder?
Yeah.
Or, right.
Yeah.
So only
until you light candles.
Until
you light candles.
So you can eat rice before.
In a Pesach pot.
But not in a Pesach pot. And here's what I just learned.
My gosh.
Because rice, and first of all, it's not traditional. So you can, okay, so it's not a traditional thing to do. That's one part of that answer. The other is that rice specifically has an enzyme. Now, somebody said to me, "Do you mean converted rice?" I was like, you know, I don't. I just use rice, so I don't even know. But it's made, there's an enzyme that is chametz.
Hmm.
It is chametz.
Interesting.
So, all rice, all.
I did not ask the question because I didn't consider. I only buy brown rice. So, you know, I only buy like rice. So I don't. I don't know.
So that would be Shiloh's to ask, because my understanding is you have to keep the laws of what you keep from that time.
Okay.
So, for instance, you wouldn't be able to have a Danone yogurt without a pea on it, right? You can't have a Chobani yogurt,
right.
Which is not chametz,
right.
And maybe not even kidney oat.
Right.
Right? Just yogurt with jam in it, even if it's made with, let's say, not high fructose corn syrup, but just sugar. You can't have that during that time. You have to eat Pesach yogurt.
I think it's worth a clarification,
yeah.
Because in my conversation, it was with Rabbi Ruskin this morning, he said, you know, you can make it in a
in a disposable pot and a disposable plate. Just don't use your pizza. So it's worth it.
Yes, it is.
Too much trouble.
It is. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating.
Wow.
Yeah,
that one's pretty, pretty tight. That one's pretty
tight. Yeah, I know. So it's like a whole. But I guess
can you make it beforehand?
I was going to say you can make it on Sunday.
But you were told you could cook it that morning.
We'll ask. Okay,
it's worth asking. But I had not known that rice itself would have. And he said so. It's not traditional.
To do that.
To do it.
Fascinating.
Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
But Sparta didn't have rice on Pesach.
So then the question that this person I was talking to said, well, what about, do they have special rice on Pesach? And I don't know. They have special rice on Pesach?
Yeah, and they triple check it. No, but they probably just buy rice without an enzyme on it. I mean, they know about these things.
Right.
So there are lists that go out for the Sephardim, what they can buy and what they can't buy. And there are lists for things that they can buy in Pesach, like Rice Krispies, if you can buy Post Rice Krispies or Kroger Rice Krispies and things like that, which ones you can buy and which ones you can't buy, because, of course, they don't have a P on them. But there's a list inside the Sephardic community that goes around of what you can and what you can't. Of that kind of stuff. Right. I know. And they keep it tight, too. Like, for instance, there is such a thing as soft matzahs.
Sephardim. Is that right?
It depends.
Because you said Moroccan.
Moroccans have a few different traditions, even inside Morocco. Some do and some don't.
I was thinking farther east.
There's Casablanca Moroccans and there's... Is Marrakesh and... They have different traditions.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, the cities have different traditions. Mm. So you have to know where you come from in Morocco. Our rabbi didn't. Even coffee and chocolate. I can't imagine. All week. It's bad enough trying to get ready for Yom Kippur.
I know.
Anyway, let's get back to our list here, which we didn't look at too much. Okay, so here's an important thing. So I thought I'll just write mitzvahs 5 through 21 minus 18. Then I said, you know what, I should write them all out because it's important to write them all out just to look at how many there are and realize that pretty much every single one of them, when you come to the section in the mitzvah that says Mishorshei HaMitzvah, right, the roots of this mitzvah are to remember the miracles that God did for us in coming out of Egypt. So looking at this sheet of paper, you have to understand there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 mitzvahs. 14 mitzvahs, that's a lot to remember one main thing for you. So I just want to read to you.
I choked on everything.
Choked
on mitzvahs. I choked on this.
Okay, I'm going to start by reading number 16 to you because this is a very important principle. We've reviewed it when we've run up against it at other times. You good? Okay, good. Not to break any bones of the Passover offering. Okay, so I'll read you. It has some interesting things in it. At the root of the precept lies the purpose to have us remember the miracles of Egypt, as we have written of the others. This is also a branch of the above root purpose. For it is not a way of honor for royal princes and counselors of the land to scrape the bones and break them like dogs. It is fit only for the hungry poor of the people to do. Therefore, at the beginning of our emergence to become a treasured choice of all nations, a kingdom of Kohanim and a holy nation, and again every year at the same time, it is fitting for us to perform deeds which reflect the great degree of excellence to which we rose at that hour. Through our action and the symbol that we perform, we set this manner in our souls permanently. So just hear that sentence again. Through the action and the symbol that we perform, we set this manner in our souls, right? So we set in our souls through action. And here now comes what he said, his principle. Now do not think, my son, to seize upon my words and ask, but why should the eternal Lord, be he blessed, command us to do all these things in order to commemorate that miracle? Would the matter not have entered our consciousness through one commemoration, and thus not be forgotten out of the mouths of our descendants? For not out of wisdom would you pounce upon me thus, but rather childish thinking would move you to speak so. And now, my son, if you have understanding, hear this. Incline your ear to hearken. I will teach you of the Torah and the precepts for your benefit. Know that a man is influenced in accordance with his actions. right? That is a principle in the Sefer Chinuch. Mm-hmm. The Sefer Chinuch is a behaviorist. We are influenced according to our actions. Next sentence, his heart and all his thoughts are always drawn after his deeds in which he is occupied, whether they are good or bad. Thus, even a person who is thoroughly wicked in his heart, and every imagination of thoughts of his heart is only evil the entire day, if he will arouse his spirit and set his strivings and his occupation with consistency in the Torah and the mitzvot, even if not for the sake of heaven, he will veer at once toward the good, and with the power of his good deeds, he will deaden his evil impulse. Mm. For after one's acts, the heart is drawn. And the opposite, even if one is thoroughly righteous, but it becomes engaged in a tax collecting or some kind of profession, which may be honest but harsh, will become a harsh person. So that's a very important thing here, that through our actions, our heart is drawn, right? Ha'adam nif'al kafi pu'ulatav. Now, it's interesting about the breaking of the bones and their ends. Let's just look at some of the other things here. Roasting. The meat has to be roasted. The Karban Pesach has to be roasted. Let's just think about the concept of roasting as opposed to other ways of cooking, right? At our seders today, we're not permitted to roast. We have to pot or steam or cook it or fry, some other type of cooking, right? What's the difference between roasting and the other types of cooking?
Well, roasting is usually over an open fire.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's dry, it's
so
by itself.
Poor people had fires and the richer people had the ovens. And
well, no, roasting can also be in an oven.
Okay.
So let's think of roasting shrinks the meat, concentrates the flavors, but gives you a little less, right? Mm-hmm. The liquid's dripping off, some of the fat is dripping off, but in the end you have something richer, more concentrated, and less of it. So that's only for rich people. Mm. Whereas boiling, right, throwing a piece of something, expands it and waters it down, makes it less tasty as a piece of meat. It may lend a flavor to a whole stew, but the meat itself is less sucky. It's expanded and diluted as opposed to contracted and concentrated. Right, so it's the way of the wealthy to be able to say, no problem, I have enough. I can totally allow this to be concentrated. My husband actually tried that dry. He dry aged a rib roast. I thought it was a waste of time and money. I guess I'm in that in between range. He's feeling wealthy. I'm feeling not so much. Right. So he took a very expensive big roast, and then put it in a special bag that he ordered just for the purpose in the back of the fridge for a month. And then after it was dry, you have to take it off and cut off the outside. Like, what a waste! Cut off the whole outside of it, yeah. And then you have super concentrated, very rich steaks or roast because it's been dried and all the flavors are concentrated in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you try it?
I think so. I'm not a super taster, so for me, my husband is that's a literal, what's that? It's a little description of somebody who has
literal.
Extra sharp.
Oh.
Extra sharp taste buds, so they can really tell. A super taster is like somebody who can hear
or smell the perfume people.
Yeah, yeah, right. So he's got that too. Yeah. You know, like extreme perfume and smell aversion, mm-hmm. and very sharp taste buds. Mm. So he can tell the difference. For me, it's just like it's a nice piece of meat. You know, it's good, whatever. But for him, like he knows. So. Anyway, that roasting, you're supposed to roast the meat, right?
So, I mean, this fine line. Uh-huh. When you cook a brisket, aren't you roasting?
No, you're potting.
Okay, because you're putting liquid in it.
Yes, mm-hmm. Okay. Right. If you put liquid in it, you're potting it. Okay. And you have to put liquid in it. I mean,
right.
Yesterday someone was asking, for the Seder, we don't serve roasted anything, not fowl either. Even though fowl can't be
vegetables.
Offered. Roasted vegetables, yes. We don't serve any roasted meats.
What do you serve?
Potted or fried.
Oh, you do potted or fried. Yeah,
potted or fried. Okay. So you can't. So somebody asked yesterday, can you take a, you know, if you put a little liquid in it, does that make it not roasted? No, it doesn't. A little liquid on the bottom. Let's say you take your whole chicken, pour some soy sauce, maple syrup or whatever, not soy sauce, some Pesach, whatever, vinegar and raspberry syrup, your Pesach ingredients, right? On top of it, and a speck of water, right, in the bottom, right? That's still roasted. put that in the oven, that's still roasting. You butterfly your chicken and you put enough like liquid that it comes up halfway or something, so that's potting already. That you can serve at the Seder. But you can't serve a roasted bird with crinkly skin on it. That's, you know, you have
or
to... If you cover it and it steams, yeah, then you can serve that. Yeah, that's different.
So you're going into this really interesting place where you're, by these laws, you're having Hashem identify between the priests and the nobles and the poor people, and saying, Jews, you need to think of yourself now as priests and nobles in terms of cooking your food, not breaking bones, and also laying down.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So absolutely.
That's really cool.
So this whole thing is about the transition, our transition into leaders of the world and our inner posture, right? Assuming that inner posture of, I am a special person, and I have a leadership capacity, and I'm supposed to step up. You know, I'll be interested to see what happens with this new pope, because, you know, with him carrying his suitcases and paying his own bill. And like,
getting on the bus.
So that's right, getting on the bus.
Went outside
so
the
lovely.
Vatican gate and greeted everybody after the mass, hand to hand.
So on the one hand, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, and on the other hand, you know, for getting security, I mean, he may have to pull back because of security.
Right.
But there's also there is a concept of kavod, that you should have a certain level of respect and honor, and you have to assume that as part of the role. No, you can't be the guy next door pope.
Right.
You know, and we can't be the guy next door Jews, lahavdil. Like, we do have a special role in the world, and we do have to assume that position of not, you do not have to be stuck up. You don't have to, you know, conflate the two, and they can often be conflated. But you do have to know that I am somebody special, and I have a special role, and I have to accomplish something special, and I can't just be like I was. I have to be somebody new. So Pesach is about the birth of a nation. Right? That's one reason why we eat the egg. I've said this in the past, but it's a good thing to remember for your Seder. Why do we eat the egg at the Seder?
Well, spring, rebirth, continuity. I mean, there's all sorts of
things. Okay, good. Spring, rebirth, continuity. Yeah. Korban Chagiga is another reason, right? So the egg on the Seder plate is because of a certain offering that we, it just represents that offering. But the egg that we eat at the beginning of the meal, so it could be spring, could be rebirth, could be renewal, could be morning, could be hungry, probably not because we just ate a bunch of maror and matzah, right? So, and we're about to have a big meal. So that part of what the egg represents is the double birth. Eggs, chicks are born twice, as are the Jews, right? Once coming out of Egypt, but then we weren't fully born. So we were taken out of the innerness of the nation, a nation from inside a nation, like the egg is taken out from the chicken pretty quickly, squeezed out, right? The egg has no choice. Then it incubates for the 49 days, or however long a chicken egg incubates, what we incubate in the desert for the 49 days with the counting of the Omer. And then we hatch at Har Sinai when we receive the mission. So for the Jew, the birth process of us as a nation is a double process. Coming out of Egypt, so the experience in Egypt really, and coming out, that's all one. But we needed the experience of being squeezed tight in Egypt and coming out. And then we also, that wasn't enough. It's not shlach et ami, period. It's shlach et ami v'avduni, send out my nation that they should serve me. It's two parts, right? Not just freedom, but towards what? Right? That there's something to accomplish here. So, so it's a double birth process, and the eggs are born, chicks are born twice. So that's one reason why we eat the eggs.
Interesting. Yeah, you've told me so many interesting things that I have never heard before about Passover. I mean,
good. I'm so
it's
blessed.
Amazing. Really good. These are all going to be gems here that we're going to.
Yeah, we're
fabulous.
So the two actions are the squeezed out and the
hatching, the incubating and the hatching. It's really two births and three parts of the process.
First the egg is born, then the chick is born.
Right. First the egg is born, and then the chick
is born. That whole concept
then incubation in the middle.
What is the egg? What's the metaphor?
Us.
I'm missing it. We are the egg.
We, the Jewish people. First we're squeezed out of Mitzrayim.
Okay.
And then we have to incubate in the desert.
Okay.
And then we hatch at Har Sinai.
Then incubate. Okay.
Right.
I was missing.
And the coming out of Egypt is likened to Mitzrayim, the birth canal. You know,
right.
They were just squeezed
out.
Canal,
right, exactly.
You know, into
the rechem.
The rechem.
Right. Going from narrowness into the expansion.
Right.
right? And that's why our first mitzvah was this newness should be the first of newnesses to you. Because as soon as we're squeezed out from the narrowness, Hashem says, okay, now time to expand, right? Now let go of that narrowness. Narrowness is done, right? And now it's time for expansion and renewal, constant reinvention. So we were brought into the reinvention zone for life. And that's one thing I want to say about being above time. That's one reason why we were released from Egypt so quickly, is we have this concept that we are above time. And that the only way the Jewish people could be formed is without time. Because we're an eternal nation. So if we were formed in time, regular, so tuma can attach itself to something very small, but not teeny. So apparently, tuma can't attach itself to something smaller than a barley piece, right? So you know what a piece of barley looks like, right? It looks half the size of a rice piece, right? Or two-thirds, depending on your rice, right? Very small. So that small isn't tame. So I'm pretty sure, I'm not positive, that a practical application would be if you're killing lice, right? You don't become tame from that because they're smaller than barley, right? So it doesn't make you tame. Right, so something tiny can't hold tuma. So in time also, in space and in time. So just a second, right? A second can't hold tuma. So that's why we say mitzvah haba liyadcha, a mitzvah that comes to your hands, and just listen to the words here, al tachmitzena. Don't tarry. Tachmitzena, that's from chametz. Don't let that mitzvah that comes into your hand become chametz. Tachmitzena.
Don't put it off.
Don't put it off, but don't let it ferment. Chametz is about fermentation, which can only happen with time. You can't make pickles overnight, right? It takes time. You can't rise bread in a minute either, even if you pour in a cup of yeast, right? It's not going to rise in a minute. Mm-hmm. It'll rise a little faster, but there is a minimum amount of time that's required for rising action to happen, for pickling action to happen, for chametz to happen, right? So it takes some time. So the Jewish people had to be born without time, because we had to be born in a way that tuma can't attach to us as a people, that the slowness can't attach to us as a people. That's why we tried at Bizrizim, to have alacrity, to do things quickly, right? I'm sure everybody knows that proof text song from Marvelous Midos Machine, right? Zrizim makdim min lemitzvos. All gedid should be done right away. The Torah says you shouldn't jerk. Roll up your sleeves and get to work. Don't put off till tomorrow something you can do today. Mm-hmm. Right? So you're supposed to zrizim makdim min lemitzvos. The ones who are quick, the ones who are behave with alacrity, they get mitzvahs first. So in a way, it's the early bird catches the worm. But it's even more than that. It is more than that, because you get the mitzvah, which is like matzah, right? Mitzvah and matzah, there's a similar sound. There's not the same, but you get the mitzvah if you're quick. But if you let it become chametz in your hands, you will not have the mitzvah anymore. So there is a concept of doing things quick. So we want to do mitzvahs quick, and we got out of Egypt quick, but part of getting out of Egypt quick, and part of also coming from barren foremothers, our foremothers, F-O-R-E, mm-hmm. right? All of them had fertility issues, except Leah, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the other three had fertility issues, right? So, and some say that they didn't even have the right organs to conceive. But part of that was that we're a miraculous people. We're conceived without normal organs. We're conceived outside of time. We're outside of nature. We have to be. And look, we still are. If you look at our history, you can see very clearly we do not make sense in the natural order of things. We shouldn't be here.
Absolutely.
Right? So, and I think here's a very important thing to say at your Seder table. Look around at each one and say, if you are here today, you are a walking, talking miracle. You're a miracle. For 3,500 years since this story, if you're a Jew by birth, that means that every generation from then till now both physically survived and chose in. Right? Even if you maybe come from not the most religious family, but you still identify as Jewish, that means your ancestors identified Jewish for 3,500 years. They survived physically and they chose in. There's plenty of people who chose out and plenty of people who didn't make it. So if you're one of the ones who's alive today identifying as a Jew, it's miraculous.
Unless you convert it.
If you're a Jew by choice, yeah, if you're a Jew by birth, right. You're a total miracle. If you're a Jew by choice also, because you are able to attach yourself to a people that doesn't, how is it that they're here? You know, and that you can attach yourself, and that Hashem allows you to attach yourself, and that your neshama has changed through that attachment process, also a miracle. Yeah, start with the Jews by birth.
You would know from your own journey, you know, a lot of people get halfway through and go, oh, this is not going to work.
Right. That's right. A lot of people do.
I can't choose this.
Yeah. Right. So anybody who's a Jew at the Seder table is a miraculous being.
Oh, that's nice.
And that's so important to share at the Seder table. This is a time of sharing, of emuna, of connection, of great stories of Jews, a time that we want to make sure that we all feel that sense of miracle and majesty, that we're here. It's amazing that we're here, and we're here for an important reason. That's what you want to convey. It's amazing that we're here, and we're here for something really important. It's exciting to be a Jew.
At this time.
At all times. It could be scary to be a Jew, but it's exciting to be a Jew. We have a lot to accomplish. So I guess we'll leave us there. And you have a chag kasher v'sameach.
You too.